I'm actually not going to preach, really. It's just a night of singing, and what I want to do tonight, instead of preaching, really teaching anything, is just have a kind of what I call assisted meditation. It's just a time to meditate on the glory of God, the power of God. And you probably won't learn a lot new tonight. I just want you to let it sink in. That's really where worship comes from, is when the truths of God's word sink into our hearts. And we don't just check them off as something we acknowledge as being true, but they go down deep to touch the affections. And that's where worship responds. And so that's my goal. My text is Genesis 1:14 through 19. And God said, "Let there be lights in the expanse of the sky." This is day 4 of the creation. "To separate the day from the night, and let them serve as signs to mark seasons and days and years, and let them be lights in the expanse of the sky to give light on the earth." And it was so. And God made two great lights, the greater light to govern the day and the lesser light to govern the night. He also made the stars. And God set them in the expanse of the sky and to give light on the earth and to govern the day and the night and to separate light from darkness. And God saw that it was good, and there was evening and there was morning, first day. When God created the heavens and the earth, he created in two waves. Days 1 to 3 was the first wave, and days 4 to 6 was the second wave. The first wave, he created the sky and then the earth and then the sea. The second wave, he filled the sky and the earth and the sea. And that's the way the creation week works. So, day 4 was the day that he filled the sky. He had created it already. Day 1, it was there, but it was empty. Day 4, he fills it up. And that's what I want to zero in on tonight, just thinking about the filling of the sky. Up until day 4, there was nothing in the sky. It was just empty space. There was no sun. It didn't exist. There were no stars, no moon, nothing up there. Just empty space, just the earth sitting there by itself. And then God said, "Let there be lights in the expanse of the sky to separate light from night, day from night." We don't really need the sun to make the earth habitable. That's what God was doing in Genesis 1, making the earth habitable. We don't need the sun for that. There was already light. There was already warmth. There was already day and night. There was already distinction. Morning and evening had been going for a few days already. People at that time that this was written, those people worshipped the sun and the moon as gods. And they, I think, are presented this way because God is showing, not only are they not gods, they're not even needed, really. They're just utilities that God put there and then delegated some tasks to that he was already doing just fine fulfilling. So they're not God's rivals, they're just his creatures. In fact, he doesn't even use, have you ever noticed in the account of the creation of the sun and the moon, the words sun and moon never appear? Why? Why does he keep calling them lights? Actually, the word is lamps. He's made these lamps. Why does he call them lamps? Why not call them sun and moon? The reason is because the sun and moon, those words were names of gods, pagan gods, that people worshipped at. And he's like, I'm not even going to call them by those names. They're just lamps. That's all they are. They have no use other than just utility. They're just serving a purpose that I designated to them. So God gives them these three jobs: separate the day from the night, to let them be the signs for seasons, days, and years, and to provide light on the earth. And the thing that's really interesting to me, after he creates the sun and the moon, how many heavenly bodies are there? How many things are in the sky? Just two. Just two. The rest of the sky is empty. And then look at the very, well, you can't look at anything right now, but the very tail end of verse 16, he just throws in this little statement at the end, and he made the stars. This little parenthetical statement thrown at the end. Oh, by the way, he made the stars. That's it. Nothing else is said. And from there, he just moves on. Now, a human writer, if you were making this up at this time, if this were something that some human being created, there would have been huge significance given to the stars. Everybody of every generation has always thought the stars were hugely significant. They believed back then that the stars controlled everybody's destiny. Some people still believe that with the horoscope stuff and everything. And even those who don't buy into the superstition, still, most people today think that the stars, the universes, all the galaxies on the universe are the primary feature of the physical world. They're so big, so vast, in comparison with the tiny little Earth, that the Earth is really nothing but a speck of dust that happens to be going around a little insignificant, little small star that's just one of millions in a nondescript galaxy in the middle of nowhere. I got an email one time from a naturalist who gave me this account of how the Earth was formed. He says, our solar system started off as some giant gas cloud billions of years ago. Most of this gas is hydrogen. So this cloud started to condense simply by its own gravitational pull in the center. It eventually became dense enough to ignite nuclear fusion. This hot burning ball of gas was and is our sun. What was left out in the outer portions was a disk of junk, which began to condense at different radii from to form the planets. Each planet contained the elements of that were left in the disk of junk. So the Earth is really just a piece of junk, literally a big piece of junk, according to that. The Earth is the way it is because it's like a little, just a pile of garbage, a little bunch of trash that kind of swirls in the corner of your backyard when it's windy. That's basically all the Earth is. And that's really a great illustration of how the naturalists tend to think about the Earth in relationship to the stars. They're really big. They're really significant. The Earth is nothing. And there's one sense in which, to them, the stars are like God. It's their God because that's the greatest reality in existence for the naturalist. And so the greatest reality in existence is basically your God. They're the highest, greatest, most transcendent, biggest, most powerful entities there are. So if Genesis 1 were a man-made account of the creation story, you'd expect the stars to really figure in a huge, prominent way. You read an account written by naturalists, and they start with a big bang, and then the stars, and that's always what's first. In Genesis, the stars barely get mentioned. All the vast, just mind-boggling reaches of outer space are relegated to hardly a parenthetical afterthought. In fact, in the Hebrew, it's even briefer than in the English. It's only one word in the Hebrew. The words "he made" aren't even there. It's just implied. It literally reads this way. God made the two great lights, greater to govern the day and the lesser to govern the night, and the stars. That's it. Just the unfathomable trillions of stars and galaxies and endless space, and all the mention they get in the creation account is one word. The stars. The Earth is most important, then the sun, then the moon, and the stars are like sprinkles on a cupcake. Just add it in at the end. Sometimes creationists we'll point out that the Earth is, the creation is amazing because the Earth just happens to be the exact right distance from the sun. That's not true. The sun is the exact right distance from the Earth. Earth was first. Sun was not billions of years older than the Earth. The Earth is 3 days older than the sun. And it was staggering for those people to hear that the God of Israel was supreme even over the stars. That was a huge, huge thing to say. And so Moses writes this account. He says God created the earth, and then he put the sun and moon up there, a couple of lamps, and then the stars, just like thrown in there like so much glitter. So tonight, what I'd like to do is just take some time and meditate on the power of God in his glitter. Just spend some time thinking about God's glitter, which is going to be plenty for us to think about. There are more galaxies in the universe than that we know of than there are grains of sand on the Earth. And if you just take one of those galaxies, our galaxy, the Milky Way, there are so many stars in just our one galaxy that if you counted them all, if you just counted them one per second, it would take you 2,500 years of constant counting. You took the stars that we know of, and you put them in piles of a million, little piles of a million each. Just the Milky Way galaxy, just our galaxy, would have 10,000 piles of a million stars. And the known universe has a million times that many, and who knows what's beyond the known universe. So, Psalm 147:4, he determines the number of the stars and he calls them each by name. Isaiah says, by his great power and mighty strength, not one of them is missing. He calls every one of them by name. You know how many names that is? That is a lot of names. You know, the English language has more words in our vocabulary than any other language in the world. And the Oxford English Dictionary, now most of us don't even know a fraction of them, but the Oxford English Dictionary is 13 volumes. It contains 500,000 words, English words. But even if you got all 13 of those volumes, and you used up every single obscure English word in all 13 volumes, you've only named one half of one pile. A half a million stars. That's all, and you're out of names. You don't have any more English words. Back in 1995, they aimed this Hubble telescope back at a little tiny spot in the sky where there were no stars. They just picked a spot that was black. Just black. There's nothing there. Tiny little spot in the sky. It's so small that it was the size, the spot that they picked was the size of a tennis ball at 100 yards. That little blip up in the sky, and they say, okay, there's a black spot that big. Let's just zoom in on that. The Hubble telescope, you know what it saw? Nothing. It was black. But they said, we're going to try something. We're just going to let it keep looking, and we're going to open up the lens for 10 days. We're just going to collect as much light as we possibly can. Just let it come in there. And the result was what they call, some photographs they call the Hubble Deep Field. And that little teeny speck of blackness in the sky, they found hundreds of galaxies where they thought was nothing. And they're all unique. That last slide was that little square was this picture. That's it zoomed in. These are all galaxies. Almost all of those are galaxies. And these galaxies are all unique. They're all different colors and shapes and sizes. And you wouldn't believe the variety of stuff that's out there in outer space. It's not just stars. Supernovas and black holes and globular clusters and comets and planets and asteroids and radiation and unknown objects. I don't even know what they are. And pulsars, and you know those pulsars, those are some interesting things. The Vela pulsar, this here is the Vela pulsar there. It's like kind of a double bow and arrow shooting out something. These pulsars are cool things. They're collapsed stars. They're super, super dense, and they rotate around, and they make different sounds. We aimed a radio telescope at that thing to see if we could hear it. And this is what that thing sounds like. See if we can get it. It just does that. It just keeps doing that day and night. Just cranks that out. There's all kinds of different pulsars, lots of different pulsars, and they all have different big rhythm they're tapping out. Some of them are super fast. Some of them are a lot slower. Psalm 19 says, the heavens declare the glory of God, and the skies proclaim the work of his hands, and day after day they pour forth speech. It's not all silent speech. I mean, some of it's literally, they're pouring out actual noise. Those pulsars are believed to be so dense that if you filled the ball of a ballpoint pen with the matter from one of those stars, your pen ball would weigh 91,000 tons. A little ballpoint pen. They emit pulses of radio waves that are so regular that, those pulses you just heard are so regular that it would take a billion years for them to change 1 second, to get off by 1 second. About 15 of those things are detected each year just by listening for them. They just keep finding them. They picked up one in 1988 to be from a galaxy 5 billion light years away. We're hearing something from there. Unbelievable. The variety of things that God has put out there in space just absolutely boggles the mind. Even if you go to the coldest, darkest place out there, it's beautiful. There is an area on the plane of our galaxy that's one of the darkest places in the whole Milky Way, and the only thing there is dust. There's no stars or anything else, just dust and emptiness. And that dust is so cold, it's just slightly above the coldest temperature theoretically attainable in the universe according to the laws of physics. I mean, it's just cold. And you know what you see when you go to one of the coldest, darkest places God ever made? There it is. It's a photograph of it. Kinds of things that happen out in outer space are just awesome beyond description. There was an explosion, for example, in outer space that happened in our Milky Way recently. It became visible in the year 1054. All of a sudden, it showed up. We saw this big bang. The explosion was visible from Earth and could be seen in the daylight for 23 days. At night, it could be seen for almost 2 years, naked eye. Big, bright, boom, explosion. This is the explosion, this next slide. They call it, that's the explosion the way it looks right now. I mean, that's a photograph of it. It's called the Crab Nebula. When they have those explosions and then you take a picture of the wreckage is called a nebula. And that thing is expanding at the rate of 700 miles per second. Just got 700 miles bigger. 700 miles each time. Scientists don't understand why it's expanding so fast. It shouldn't be going that fast. According to what they can figure from an explosion, they do the calculations, it should not be going that fast. They don't know why. Cloud of wreckage from that explosion, what you're looking at there, or the Crab Nebula, where is that thing? Go back to that. There you go. That thing, that's 10 light years across. If we reduce the universe, just so you can get a handle on that, because I know light years don't mean anything, but it's 6 trillion miles as a light year. If we reduce the universe down to the size where the Earth is right here, and then the moon is a half an inch away, right here, and then the sun is like over by that wall there, 10, 15 feet away, if you make everything that small, that is the size of the United States on that scale. It's a really big explosion. And at the center of that thing is the Crab Nebula. And that Crab Nebula, that one, that is the Crab Nebula. At the center of the Crab Nebula is a pulsar, the Crab Pulsar, that is, that one goes really fast. In fact, that same website, if you look, there's one, I think right below it is the Crab Pulsar. And I don't know if we'll be able to pull that up, but this one, it emits these sounds super. Yeah. That one's cranking. Every one of those sounds is a whole revolution of the thing. That's 30 per second is what you're hearing. 30 revolutions per second. That pulsar is the mass of our sun, but it's the size of a small town. Just crammed in. Here's another explosion. That next slide there, that's another explosion. in fact, go to the next one after that. There's another one. How about the next one? Just some examples of some of the awesome explosions out there. God definitely didn't make these things out of a cookie cutter. They're all different. So when the Bible says that God just sprinkled the stars out there like so much glitter, he's making quite a statement about the immense power of this God that we worship. When you watch, I mean, he wouldn't have had to make it that big. When you watch Star Wars and they're traveling at the speed of light, and you know, you look out the window of the ship and the, you know, the stars are kind of floating by like phone poles, you know, and then when they zoom, they accelerate, and all of a sudden they become a blur zooming past. Traveling at the speed of light is a fantasy. We can't do that. But even if we could do that, the stars would not be a blur. I want to try and help you understand some of the distances out there. Stars are so far apart. It wouldn't be a blur. In fact, if you're going at the speed of light, they wouldn't even float past you like telephone poles on the highway. Traveling at the speed of light, if you got into a dense cluster of stars, a galaxy, even that in that dense cluster, it takes years and years going the speed of light to go between one from one star to the next, close by star. Let's just take a journey here. Suppose you could travel at the speed of light. Now, light is some very fast stuff. Light goes really fast. If you if a train were on a track that went all the way around the whole circumference of the globe, or the oceans and everything, just 24,000 miles all the way around the Earth, you built a train track, you had this train going around this track at the speed of light, and you tripped and fell down on this track, you would get run over 7 times per second until you got up. This is how many times, this is how often you'd get run over by this train, this whole train. Okay? That's how many times. Now, if you're wondering, you say, wow, that's what it's like. If you're wondering what it would sound like if it weren't you, if it weren't you that fell, but if it were Doug Clark that fell on the track, and he said he was saying ow every single time he got run over, it would sound like this. Just in case you're wondering about that. Now, here's this will give you some perspective. Suppose you could travel to speed of light. You could hitch your car. You get in your car, your minivan, whatever you got, and you could hitch that up to a light beam coming from the sun and just take off the speed of light, 186,000 miles per second. If the light beam left the sun at 6, say it left at 6 o'clock this morning, Sunday morning, leaves the sun, right when your alarm went off at 6, you would have 8.5 minutes to get up, get dressed, get ready, get in your car before that beam zooms by your house. That's how long it takes that beam to travel the 93 million miles from the sun to the earth. And so you latch on, and now you're traveling at the speed of light. Now, these slides are just to give you some relative sizes here. One thing about this topic, the sizes that we're going to be talking about are so large, so unfathomable, that they mean nothing to us, and you can't compare them unless you keep reducing the scale down each time by orders of magnitude. If you don't do that, you can't even make the comparisons. So we got to keep doing that. So, for example, here, if you want to understand the size of, you know, Earth compared to Pluto, you can look at that. If you want to understand the size of Jupiter, this model here is not helpful. You have to go to this next slide. And there, now you can see Jupiter. Jupiter's really big. See the Earth there? That's, you had to reduce the scale down. That's what I'm talking about. Now, if you want to think about the sun, you need a whole other scale. There's the sun. See Jupiter? And now Earth's a little dot. Now, that's not really the sun. This next one is. There's the sun. Now, that is an awesome thing. I mean, that is blazing, raging fire. I mean, it is a ball, giant ball of raging fire, 10,000 degrees Fahrenheit at the surface, like billions of nuclear bombs going off simultaneously all day, day and night, constantly. It is an incredible, massive thing, more gigantic than anything we can possibly imagine. A million Earths could fit inside the sun, and that sun just rages with explosions of fire day and night, year after year. The flares that shoot out of that thing, like that one shooting out there, I mean, they go millions of miles into space. Just those little flares. If we got anywhere near one of them like that, the Earth would just be instantly incinerated, even if we were, you know, a couple million miles away. This God that we were just singing to, who was here in this room listening to us, into existence that kind of a thing. I mean, that's the thing. He speaks things into existence like that. And he is the God before whom every person in this room will someday, on Judgment Day, appear and have to give an account. That God. And if you want to compare the sun to some medium-sized stars, then you can, like Arcturus, for example, then you get this, a whole other scale. There's our sun. There's Arcturus. But if you want to compare the sun to some large stars, then you got a whole other thing. You got this next one. Look at Betelgeuse and Antares. Arcturus, you see that? It's that third one just to the left of the white one. I mean, you just got to keep, there you go. You just got to keep reducing the scale. It's just awesome. That if Betelgeuse were our star, then we would be, our orbit would be inside it. That's how big it is. So you hook up your tow rope to this light beam, and it's 6:08 in the morning, and you're off. You're flying at that speed that train was going. 1.4 seconds, and you're past the moon. That's how fast you're going. Within the hour, you're going past Saturn already, and you're wondering, as you go by Saturn, what the deal is with these huge plumes of ice shooting out of one of Saturn's moons. Go to that next slide there. That's one of Saturn's moons. Ice shooting up out of there. I mean, there's just crazy stuff going on out there. By the time your family is sitting down for morning coffee back home, a little before 7 o'clock, you're flying by Jupiter. About the time you pass Pluto, you're wishing you'd never even gone on this trip because now it's 11 o'clock. You've already missed a sermon. Church. At that speed that the train was going around, running over you 7 times a second, you're going that fast for 4 hours in order to get out to Pluto. But Pluto's not the end of the solar system. In fact, we get up tomorrow, Monday morning, we get up, we all get up, go to work, we go to bed, we work Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, all the way through the whole week. We're getting off work at Friday afternoon, and finally you're leaving our solar system. 4 hours to Pluto, a week to get the rest of the way. And hopefully you brought along a few CDs. You had the foresight to bring some tapes or something, because maybe downloaded some sermons, because you're traveling now out in some really empty space. And there's no scenery. There's nothing to look at. Hopefully you got something to listen to in your car. You don't get to see anything now until you go past the nearest star to our sun. And that's going to take you midway through the year 2014. Now remember, we're going the speed of light. This is light speed. It's 2014 before you get the first star. So after 2 years of not seeing anything out your window, and the kids ask, "Are we halfway there yet?" The answer is no, we're not halfway there, because it's going to take 4.2 years to get to that first star. And don't forget, this is at the speed of light, which is, we know we can never reach that. It's a physical impossibility. Although, you know, we can go really, really fast. We've come up with some fast stuff. The Voyager spacecraft is really zooming out there. Do you know that thing's moving right now at 40,000 miles an hour? That thing's... We built a spacecraft that right now, it's out there going 10 miles per second. Every second. Just went another 10 miles. Can you imagine? I mean, this is even that blows my mind. From here to Los Angeles in a minute and a half. And it's been going that fast since 1977 when we launched that thing. You know how far away it is right now? 10 billion miles. We built something that's 10 billion miles away right now. So that thing's really hauling. We get some great pictures from the planets from the Voyager. That's why we sent it up there, take some photos of the planets. Remember a second ago when you were passing Pluto and you had to wait 40 years before you saw the next thing, or 4 years before you saw the next thing out your window? How long is it going to be before Voyager gets its next chance to take a picture of something? I mean, it took its last picture of Pluto, and now it's waiting. Take a picture of something else. They'll see something else. How long before it gets to the closest star? I mean, it's going fast, right? 40,000 miles an hour, 10 miles every second. It's hauling. How long till the first star? Just 625 million years to the first star. If you think we're going to be traveling between the stars, don't get your hopes up. 40,000 miles an hour is way too slow. So let's go back to the speed of light, because otherwise we'll be here all night. We'll crank it up back to 6 trillion miles an hour, and we'll just set it on cruise control and just go for another 7 years. Now you're beginning to wish you grabbed maybe another few more CDs, because there really isn't much action out your window anymore, and you've been traveling at the speed of light now for over a decade, 10 years, and you've only passed 20 stars. And remember, this is a dense cluster of stars. You're in a galaxy. By now the trip is getting long, kids are getting hungry, so you double check your speedometer. You make sure you're still going the speed of light. It's like, it doesn't seem like I'm going very fast. Yep, still traveling 6 trillion miles an hour. And so you're curious. You know, you want to see the other side of the Milky Way. You figure, as long as I've been doing this long, I might as well get out there. And so you're going to make your way across the galaxy, just over to the other side of the Milky Way galaxy. I mean, after all, how much longer could it take? You're going 6 trillion miles every single year. And you've been going for 4 years already. So you check your map. Just 82,000 years left just to cross our rest of our galaxy. Our galaxy's 100 light years across. Or 100,000 light years across. 100,000 light years. But at least you got some pretty spectacular scenery along the way. Here's the Milky Way. Now that, of course, is not a photograph. It's made up, actually, of a composite of groups of photographs, but we've never been outside the Milky Way. We just take a photograph of the whole thing. But that's the way scientists look at other galaxies. They know enough about our galaxy. They know what it looks like. That's what it looks like. It's a pinwheel galaxy, a barred spiral galaxy. And if you're having trouble spotting your house, it's right there. Here, go to that. There it is. See that? That's you. That's where we are in this galaxy. You can't actually see our solar system, our sun, on this picture because it's way too small. It'd be a dot way smaller than you could possibly see in this size, our sun. Looking at our sun from this distance would be like looking at a picture of the North American continent and trying to spot a quarter on the ground. So our sun's kind of small. God placed us right in that spot on purpose. That is a cool spot. For one thing, any other spot and we're dead. But not only is that the ideal spot for life, to support life, but it's the ideal spot for scientific discovery. He's got us right in between the bands so we can see out. You know, if we were in one of those bands, one of those spirals, we could see nothing. We'd never have any idea that there's any stars out there or anything out there. He put us right where we could see and discover and marvel at his awesome power. For example, he wanted us to see our nearest neighbor, the spiral galaxy M31. There it is. Most galaxies are spiral galaxies, but even if you keep your eyes open very and really watch in this journey you're on, you might be able to see some other kinds of galaxies, maybe not a spiral one, but maybe like a polar ring galaxy like this one. Isn't it amazing that things that big have particular shapes and characteristics? I mean, this just the sizes of these things are immense beyond imagination. And I read about these things, these polar galaxies. Bottom line is, I don't know why they're shaped that way. I think it's because God didn't want them all the same shape, but that's just me. Anyway, 82,000 years have passed, and you're finally glad to be leaving the Milky Way. You're tired of weaving in and out of 100 billion stars, and so now you're out there. I mean, you're in deep, empty, empty space. By now, you're beginning to realize that you're never going to make it to all the 50 billion galaxies that we know about, and so you just say, well, I'll just maybe check one of them out. So you head to one you remember seeing from back home with the naked eye, the Andromeda galaxy. You can see this from the Earth with the naked eye. So you say, I'll head over there. But again, it just seems like it's taking forever. You finally arrive and you look at your watch and realize It's been 2.5 million years. Going at the speed of light still. Do you know that you can, with your naked eye, look up in the sky and see something that's 2.5 million light years away? That's 2.5 million times 6 trillion miles. If that helps, I don't know if that does anything for you. If it doesn't do anything for me. So, on the way, as you're there in the middle of deep space, you start getting the feeling that you're being watched. You wonder if God's out there looking at you, because especially during the 1,000 years you spend flying by the Hourglass Nebula. It's a photograph of the Hourglass Nebula. Or maybe the Helix Nebula. Or a stardust ring. Anyway, by now you figure, well, we've come this far. We might as well, we've traveled speed of light for 2.5 million years. We might as well go another 26 million years. And so you go another 26 million, and you end up at the Sombrero Galaxy. You're going to love this one. That's not bad, is it? That is cool. I love that. And you say, well, it's kind of thin. It is. It's kind of thin for a galaxy. It's really thin. I mean, it's super wide, but top to bottom, it's paper thin. It's just several trillion miles from top to bottom. Several trillion miles. The reason it looks that way is because from our vantage point, which is the only vantage point we could ever possibly have because we're stuck here on Earth, that's what we see. That's the angle we get. Say, I want to see a galaxy that's flat. It's tipped up like that. Well, you're in luck. This next one you can see. This one's, we get the top view. There it is. That's what it looks like from the top, another galaxy. They think there's a black hole at the center of that one. That thing over on the right is just another galaxy. It's way far away. Don't worry about it. So again, at this point, your kids ask once more, is this, if you're halfway, you're headed toward the edge of the known universe. If you're headed to the edge of the known universe and they ask you if you're halfway now, you come to 26 million years, and you have to say, no, we're not halfway. We're not even 1/1,000th of 1% of the way yet. It's going to take us another 20 billion years. Do you know Isaiah 42:12 says, he marked off the heavens with the span of his hand. We use these light years, and they disappear into meaninglessness, because even a light year is unfathomable, and then we have unfathomable numbers of that times unfathomable numbers of that, and it's just, we can't even think. And God looks at the whole thing, and he says, oh, that's about like that size. I mean, this God we worship is huge, awesome, powerful. Tell me again what this problem is in your life that's too big for God, and you have to worry. So far, these are all things we can see. Can you imagine what we can't see? Imagine what's beyond this. You know, in 1989, two Harvard astronomers discovered what they call the Great Wall. And it's the Great Wall is spelled with capital letters, capital G, capital W. It's a wall. It's capitalized because it's the largest thing there is. It's a wall of galaxies. It's a wall of thousands and thousands of galaxies stretching millions of light years all across the known universe. This giant wall of galaxies. And this wall is supposedly 500 million light years long, 200 million light years wide, 15 million light years thick. And again, they put it in capital letters because, quote, it was the quote, largest single coherent structure seen so far in nature. 1989. Then came 1990, and God opened another little window for us, and some astronomers discovered more than a dozen evenly distributed walls of galaxies stretching across vast expanses of the heavens, suggesting a structure to the universe that's so regular and immense that it just absolutely defies current theories of cosmic origins. This newly discovered pattern of galactic walls dwarfs the Great Wall, which is now written in small, lowercase letters. It's just the Great Wall. It was only capitalized for 1 year. That's how long the gods of this world last. The biggest thing they can conceive of, it's not big very long. Now they say the Great Wall is just the closest one of these walls. I don't know what kind of arrangement God has these walls set up in, but I'm guessing the view from heaven is pretty cool. I think there's a purpose for those walls. Psalm 104:31, may the glory of the Lord endure forever, and may the Lord rejoice in his works. I bet he loves looking at those walls. Job 38:7, God says that when he laid the foundation of the earth, all the angels shouted for joy. It's all what he did. He just made this stuff, and they just burst out in shouts of joy. The whole heaven, he just erupted. Look at that. Look at those walls. God's making another point in that passage. It's a different point, but he just can't resist throwing in the mood in heaven when he did it. It is good. Oh, it is good. It is good. It is very good, he kept saying. Those are expressions of pleasure. Imagine the look the Son and the Father gave each other that moment when they formed just these fully formed galaxies just exploded into existence at their command. God was thrilled about it, excited about it. I can just imagine him looking at the sun and saying, nice. But you know what? That's not what thrilled him the most. It's really not. Job 26:14 says that all this that we've seen is but the fringe of his works. How faint the whisper we hear of him. Who then can understand the thunder of his power? There's the whisper. I don't know if we want to hear the thunder. It's just a fringe. Thunder is something else entirely. How did all that massive, inconceivable, mind-numbing, staggering universe come into existence? It was just that one last word at the end of day four, right at the end when God says, how about some stars? That's how it happened. And all those galaxies and billions of stars, Psalm 8 says, just the work of his fingers. And I have a question I want to know. If that's the work of his fingers, what could his arm do? What could his arm do? When God sent Gabriel to come and make the announcement to the Virgin Mary about Jesus, Gabriel started making the journey, and he starts out, climbs over those walls, starts making his way across whatever unimaginable expanses there are between heaven and the edge of the known universe, and then he skipped across the 20 billion light years across the known universe, gets to the Milky Way, and then he ducked around those last 100 billion solar systems in the Milky Way to get to our solar system, and then he kept moving within closer to the sun, and Gabriel's moving. He's got this message from Mary, and he finally gets within 3.7 billion miles of the earth. At that moment, what did he see? I can show you what he saw. I can show you what he saw, because we have a photograph of it. The Voyager, when the Voyager was 3.7 billion miles away, it turned around. They told it, hey, stop, turn around, take a picture of the earth. And it did. Let's take a look at this picture. This is what Gabriel saw when he got 3.7 million miles away. Isn't that something? If you haven't seen anything there, you say, wait a second, that's like the pictures I throw away when I get my thumb over the lens or something. I don't get it. No, that's a cool picture. They got the lines there so you can see. In between those lines, see that? This is a famous photograph. It's titled The Pale Blue Dot. That dot, there you go. That's us. That's us. The sun was in the background there, and so it just had some beams of light. Just happened to get caught right in the midst of a beam from the sun. The earth takes up less than one pixel of the photograph. And here, let me zoom it up here so you can see the closer picture. Go to the next one. There it is. In all the vast expanses of space, you know, only God could possibly navigate to the Milky Way galaxy. How would you even know where to go? And in the incomprehensible expanses of our galaxy, only God himself could possibly navigate to our little solar system that you can't even see. And within our solar system, you could really look around a long time before you notice that dot. Right? It's a speck inside a speck inside a speck inside a speck. It would be easier to find one particular molecule lost in the Pacific Ocean. And so when naturalists look and see that, they just say, they conclude, well, you know what? We're nothing. We're nothing. We're as insignificant as we could possibly be. And yet on that little speck, you realize every human being who has ever been born, lived out his days on that speck. Every book that's ever been written, every love affair that's ever happened, every invention everyone's ever been born, every prayer that's ever been prayed, all of us taking place on that little pale blue dot. The psalmist said, when I consider your heavens and the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars that you have made, what is man that you are mindful of him, and the son of man that you care for him? And it just seems ridiculous that God would care at all about such tiny specks of nothing on a little tiny speck. The naturalist looks at the universe and concludes that we're nothing, we're insignificant. That is not the conclusion of the psalmist. The psalmist goes on in the next verse. What is man? You crown him with glory and honor. You made him ruler over the works of your hands, and you put everything under his feet. If these vast expanses are the work of his fingers, what could his arm do? You want the answer to that question? A young girl 2,000 years ago gave us the answer to that question. Mary told us what his arm could do. I've saved the most awesome picture to last, the photograph that's most staggering of all. That's what his arm could do. You want to see the work of God's fingers, look at the infinite universe, but if you want to know the work of his mighty arm, listen to the words of the Virgin Mary, Luke 1:51. He has performed mighty deeds with his arm, and he scattered those who are most proud in their innermost thoughts. As the old song says, his most awesome work was done, the frailty of his son. It's awesome. It's staggering to think about the fringe of his handiwork. But the gospel is the mightiest work of all. I didn't get it up here. I meant to put an empty tomb. Just imagine yourself looking at a photo, the next photo of an empty tomb. There's the power of God.
Amen.
There's the power of God.
Hallelujah.
And that's what we're here to celebrate, sing about, and worship in response to tonight.